All right, and we're rolling. This is Mark Goldberg with the UN Affairs blog, UN Dispatch, and I'm talking today with Ambassador Thomas Pickering, the author of a new article about the UN's role in Iraq in the International Institute for Strategic Studies' journal Survival. Mr. Ambassador, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
So I guess, you know, maybe by way of introduction, Tom Pickering, you are ambassador to the UN, to Israel, to Russia, to India, to Jordan, and a few other countries I couldn't keep in my memory at this point.
That's right.
You know, we're going to talk today mostly about your article in which you ask the question, does the UN have a role in Iraq? And maybe I'll turn it over to you to summarize your answer.
Sure, I'd be delighted to do that. The article really says that the present role the UN is playing is kind of rudimentary and elemental, but serious. They played an important role, for example, in setting up elections, and they played an important role in helping to put together the government. The article that I wrote is most concerned, however, with the future, with what is seemingly the lack of a program for political negotiations and efforts to reach an end to the conflict, that almost all conflicts of this type have ended one way or another with a political workout, sometimes imposed by the victors, sometimes negotiated between the parties, more often than not now these days negotiated by third parties on the outside. And that's the role I see for the United Nations, and I think the U.S. has been remiss in not pursuing over the last 5 years a negotiated solution to Iraq. I say the solution has two central focal points, each closely interrelated. One is, of course, the solution inside Iraq, the question of what kind of future governance can be in place and be more permanent than what we have now, and then how to deal with some of the other critically important questions of a federation, the question of minority rights with majority rule and the limitations on both, the issue of economic future for Iraq, and particularly the major question they've been wrestling with for a long period of time, how to divide the oil revenue. The regional issue has to do very much with how the regional parties deal with Iraq and how they themselves, in particular, deal in the future with the region. And by that, I mean, are they prepared, are they able, are they willing to establish a more permanent stability in and around Iraq? They, of course, all would play a role in an Iraqi civil war, and they need to play a role in avoiding an Iraqi civil war. And then secondly, the parties themselves need to be intimately involved in such questions as, can there be stability and arms control in the region? Can there be a organization or a method for resolving border disputes and treating ethnic minorities fairly? And can there, over the longer run, be a situation in which there might be guarantees for the states in the region that don't go nuclear, that they will not be subject to nuclear threats and blackmail? And then finally, none of this, in my view, can take place without the U.S. as an essential party. But the U.S. can't do it all on its own. And the regional players are, in my view, not going to be cooperative unless other pressures are brought to bear. And some of those can be brought to bear by the five permanent members of the Security Council, and perhaps states like Germany and Japan and even India, which from time to time have taken an interest in the future of Iraq and the region, and could be very instrumental, particularly if they acted in concert in bringing the question to solution. The negotiator, in my view, he or she, should be from the United Nations. The United Nations is in a peculiarly interesting position to provide someone who is broadly neutral, widely conversant with the area, able to speak, I think, necessarily, certainly in Arabic and English to get the process done, put together the necessary team that has to do that, and work with the United States and others to make that happen. That should not be an American appointment, although we recognize the reality is that that UN appointment by the Secretary General would also have to carry at least some sense of consent or support on the American side. That's more than you wanted to know, but that's a brief outline of the major points in the article.
No, it's a good outline. You know, it seems that a critical element would be who this individual is. Do you have any names? Do you have a short list in your mind of who this might be?
I think there are short lists in the minds of many people that I've discussed with, not all the same. I think that the mere mention of a name would probably doom it to catastrophe. So I'm not going to mention names, but there are a number of people in the area, I think, who have this capability and who indeed might be willing to serve if approached properly and were basically fully supported. A central feature of this has to be that the United Nations on its own, the Secretary General on his own, is not sufficiently powerful, I think, to bring to bear the kind of activities, pressures, and interests that have to be used to persuade the parties to come along. And so it is critical, in my view, that this United Nations effort receive the support of the key member states of the organization. That's another reason why I think this third circle, as I've described it, beyond the region and beyond Iraq, of some of the major players in the Security Council and beyond, be part of the effort and be brought together to try to make it work.
It does seem to me that sort of a critical variable would be sort of the space with which the U.S. is willing to give to this individual to perform his or her task. I mean, what one can imagine, for example, a scenario in which the negotiator might want to, maybe ask the Kurds to cede, part of their control of Kirkuk, or perhaps maybe negotiate a deal with the Sunnis that might involve a sort of a timeline for U.S. withdrawal in order to gain their accession to some sort of negotiated settlement. And I guess I'm wondering sort of what likelihood do you see the U.S. giving that kind of necessary operating space to this individual?
The present administration, under current circumstances, I see little likelihood, mm-hmm. although they aren't getting anywhere. They're in a deep hole, and they need to stop digging. And this is an alternative effort. And indeed, the outcome, in my view, of a resolution, particularly in Iraq, of this issue, would be so much further ahead from where we are now. And the United States has tried to avoid linking itself too firmly with one side or the other, and indeed it has swung like a pendulum between Shia and Sunni, depending upon the region, depending upon the circumstances, and depending upon the problem at hand. The United States, in my view, doesn't have a vested long-term interest in having either a Shia or a Sunni-dominated Iraq. It has a long-term vested interest in a federation under circumstances in which each side can play a serious role in the future of the country, and each side will have to understand that it will have to accommodate and get along with the others, otherwise there won't be an Iraq.
I guess then, do you see then sort of this idea of having sort of, a diplomatic double down and of having, the UN play an outsized role to what it's currently doing, almost wholly dependent on the outcome of the U.S. election then? It seems that, one candidate would seemingly not be quite willing to pursue that kind of diplomatic option, at least,
Yeah, we don't know this, but I would say that there are several critical benchmarks that have to be taken into mm-hmm. account to make this happen. One is, interestingly enough, the surge. Were the surge to have failed, and I don't think it has failed, but I also don't think it has succeeded, were the surge to have failed, there might be a more energetic interest in seeking this kind of an approach to a solution. The surge having made progress, it provides a basis, interestingly enough, for this kind of progress. And so you can take it round or flat. In my view, it adds up to the same thing. The second benchmark, obviously, would be whether between now and the elections, the U.S. administration would wake up to the possibilities that, okay, what do we do after the surge? And something that it has, I think, scrupulously ignored, but its most famous and indeed most persuasive general has talked about incessantly, a political workout, a political solution, a political end point to the conflict we're engaged in. We've talked about it incessantly, but I've never seen any plan. And if indeed it is being worked on, it's being worked on in such a dark room behind so many veils, so covered that none of us have had any inkling one way or another, either as a result of their success or failure that it's being engaged in. The third benchmark, Mark, is the issue of will there be in the course of bringing in a new administration, and that undoubtedly will happen, a serious interest in this as a way to move forward. I say in my article that withdrawal is not a solution. It is prolonging the problem in another direction. And indeed, my view is quite seriously that the uncertain circumstances in the future of Iraq, the propensity for civil war, and indeed the propensity for an international civil war involving the four big neighbors, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, and Syria at least, is serious enough to want to guard against it now. So that it is critically important that we begin to work on a political solution, if indeed we are looking at early withdrawal, because it is a political solution that can provide some of the framework, not for a total withdrawal, in my view, but for a drawdown. And indeed, one of the things that I think might well happen is that were we able, with the help of the international community, to interest particularly the permanent members of the Security Council in moving in this direction, they themselves would probably ask that we stay on a little while longer to continue to help provide the security necessary, the tranquility, relatively speaking, necessary to give this particular approach a chance to work effectively.
I guess the question is, I mean, how much patience is there in the United States, though, for continued presence, even if, progress towards a political solution might be happening?
I think that's right. On the other hand, I think increasingly we are seeing a contribution of the surge to an ability to look at the problem, even more importantly, with the head rather than with the heart. And the head work here that's required means, in fact, that, of course, as an exit strategy, getting out of Iraq is an imperative. Staying in the long term, creating a base structure, making it a colony of the United States, or a semi-colony is not on. It won't work. It's not a solution. But getting out prematurely is equally bad because we in effect say we came in, we caused chaos, and we attempted to staunch that chaos. We really failed. We have no political construct to suit the parties so that they have a continued interest in a more stable state, and we're leaving it in a period of chaos, and in effect we're opening the door to the neighbors all intervening in one side or another, so that in fact you could say the current situation or the situation 8 months ago is likely to reappear in spades if we're not careful about what we do.
I guess, you know, there's the argument that if the U.S. or when the U.S. withdraws, you know, things will get worse there following thereafter. Almost seems to be an argument for perpetual troops in perpetual American occupation of Iraq. And I'm wondering sort of when would be an appropriate moment then for the U.S. to begin?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Mark, I agree with you. I share that conclusion. As one of the candidates has said, he's prepared to stay 100 years. Well, that's a kind of mindless commitment. If you're not prepared to work toward a solution to the issues that have given rise to the conflict that we helped to generate, then, in fact, you may be in a 100-year mess. But I'm suggesting a different way. And we all know that diplomacy is a very tough course, that under these kinds of conditions there is no silver bullet, and I would never argue that, but it is a road yet untried, and it is a road which over the years, whether it has been in Vietnam or Korea or in other areas, I watched it in El Salvador, has all been able to make a contribution to working out the answer to the problem. And my view is that we have been woefully remiss in not having started that early on, and we are now continually remiss in not having energized ourselves to deal with the problem. And I would not say it's an easy problem, and it gets tougher every day. So the longer we wait, the harder it is to make it go. And without that necessary addition, I would support your conclusion that seemingly military force alone is not going to resolve this problem, and it is not getting better by staying in longer. Quite the contrary, I think it will make conditions worse.
Obviously, good points all. I wanted maybe to explore maybe how your argument might be, the argument in your paper there might be felt within the UN itself. I mean, I imagine if I was working in the UN system and I saw sort of the United States, you know, turn to the UN, hat in hand, saying, "You got to help us out now," I might have mixed feelings, to say the least. You know, it seems that, you know, this was a war that many in the UN system opposed from the start, war in the U.S. against embarking on. But now that things are sort of deteriorating to the extent that they are, the U.S., you know, is almost sort of compelled to come back to the U.N. And, it's actually, you know, the scale of UN involvement in Iraq is a controversial issue, I'm sure, as you know, within the UN itself, within staff members. You know, UN, you know, people have been killed in Iraq. We've had, you know, it almost seems as if the U.S. is turning to the UN to bail it out. And I'm wondering, how do you alleviate those fears and those concerns within the UN system?
Mark, it's a great question. It's one that I've worried about from the start. There is no UN interest in having the U.S. slide this terrible problem into their lap and say, it's now yours, we're getting out. The issue is, in my view, one where American diplomacy has to begin the process, and it has to begin the process working in three spheres, with the Iraqi parties, with the regional parties, and more importantly, and maybe as a first effort, with those states that I define in the paper as sort of the world parties. I think that Britain and France, with serious U.S. commitment behind this, would go. I've just been in Russia. I don't know whether the Russians would support this or not, but I have an indication that from their speeches and other things they've said, they think diplomacy needs to play a role in the answer to this problem, and they are not averse to being asked to play that kind of a role, provided their ideas are listened to and provided, as I say in the paper, we don't ask them for money and troops up front to be part of the solution to the problem. I think similarly China would follow. This means, in fact, that before I would go to the United Nations and seek the Secretary General's support to appoint a team led by a principal negotiator, as I've described it, I would put all of these pieces in place. I think it is extremely important that we would go to the Russians and say, for example, if Iraq falls into pieces and turns into a colossal mess, it will begin to look like another Afghanistan. And Afghanistan has have been the source of as many problems for you as it has been for us. And we don't need another ungoverned area dominated by those who would bring terrorist training camps and all the rest, Al-Qaeda, to the fray. I think with respect to the Chinese, you would take a different tack and say that there continue to be serious problems with oil prices. We've just hit X number, well above 100. There's likely to continue to go. Real breakdown in Iraq, real confusion, indeed real chaos, would only add to the uncertainties in this sphere and drive us all nuts. And we're all very much energy dependent. We're going to be here for quite a while, even if we can figure out good ways to get around it. So bringing a solution to Iraq, I can't confect that out of the top of my head, but I think I know what some of the principles are, would be very, very important for us all to work on. And we, the Americans, are prepared to listen to any ideas that you've got. We have no preset views that will dictate what our support will be to a solution. Let us sit and see if we can find a solution. Generally speaking, it's been my experience that those other folks, with rare exceptions, don't have a lot of ideas. They will come back to us and say, well, what are your ideas? And that gives us an opportunity at least to say, well, we've looked at this for a long time. Here are two or three things. What are your reactions? But if we put it into that kind of a process and say that we need your support for a political workout and we're prepared to back this up and be part of it, but we need to do this in an unusual gesture on our part, working together, trying to solicit the best ideas from all sources, this has, in my view, some chance. Not a huge chance, and I would be the last to say that this is a magic bullet, as I said earlier.
I guess there could be a worry, though, you know, within the UN that they might be set up for failure in a way, that they're being asked to take on a task which might be impossible. And once having taken it on, success or failure is a judgment about sort of the UN and how the UN operates. So, you know, if I was...
Yeah, you know, my view there, Mark, is that one way or another they're going to have to deal with failure if it occurs. The notion that we're prepared to try to put together the nexus of member support, what I would call the best of all possible arrangements for UN success, should in itself be at least persuasive of the fact that this is not a harebrained idea with no support. But until we get that, it is useless to mention it at the UN and say, you guys ought to take the lead and put it all in place. That won't work. It has to depend on the critical member state support across that body to make it
work. I have to completely agree with what you said about the UN, like you said, will end up being the body dealing with failure in any event. Right now, I mean, they're already taking care of refugees in Iraq and in Syria and Jordan, and they're dealing with the humanitarian mess associated with
it. Yeah, we know that, and we know, in fact, that the UN has existence beyond its member states, but it's very thin on the ground. It's some of the specialized agencies. It's the Secretariat. It's the Secretary General. But with the support of its member states and with a plan on how to move ahead, then it becomes, in that regard, a much more effective body than it ever has been. And I watched that happen during the first Gulf War.
How so? Could you maybe explain? Yeah.
Well, I think the Security Council stayed together on 12 critically important resolutions. They imposed sanctions, which were applied. They authorized the use of force for a coalition under a set of circumstances which were difficult but not impossible. They opened the door to seeing what could be done to get Saddam out of Kuwait in those days without the use of force, and when that failed, it used force effectively to make that happen. It didn't achieve all the objectives everybody had in mind, but nevertheless left, I think, the region and the world in a more stable situation than it had been, would have been had they failed to act together.
I was wondering, earlier you alluded to sort of ideas and elements for a political solution, and I was wondering if you might maybe sort of offer some ideas or suggestions of your own that sort of the mythical UN negotiator might want to pursue.
Well, the negotiator, as I said earlier, will have to seek as a primary issue putting together a government and an effective governance structure in Iraq that can work for more than the current period. That means, in effect, that he will have to work very closely with the Iraqi leaders on a very difficult task of how to define the size and shape of a federation. I have been persuaded by people more expert than I in Iraqi affairs that a 18-province federation is much better than a tripartite federation. But that will have to be tried out. Secondly, they will have to define, in the terms of the Iraqi constitution, the roles that can be played by the minority and how, in fact, the majority can win, because we understand that Iraqi elections for a long time to come are going to be ethnically determined, and that needs to be addressed. There has to be worked out a special role for the Kurdish minority, who indeed over these past years have defended themselves but have also played a cooperative role with us and others in trying to bring about a solution to the problem without breaking up the state, an option that they thought they might have had, but we all know is politically now, I think, so out of the question that they have to take continually the Kurds' second best. So they need to be brought in. We need to find a way to provide for those human and civil rights that seem to be totally absent from the Iraqi situation now, but which are going to govern in the long run the behavior of people and their work. We need, obviously, to decide the money questions, and they're big. Who gets what coming out of the oil income? Is it going to be biased one way or another? Certainly the Sunni feel that both in monetary terms and in governance terms, if they're not on top, they're going to be on the bottom. The Shia feel that they've been on the bottom as a majority for so long that they now have to be permanently on top. Neither of those is, of course, the answer to the question, and compromises will have to be made between them. But I think it's certainly well within the construct of man to bring that about. As I said, there's a regional focus as well. We want the regional players to support the solution. In order to do that, they have to be aware that the solution will not prove to be a major threat to them or to their co-religioners or their co-ethnics inside. We need also, I think, to help to stabilize the region. There are many things that were done between NATO and the former Soviet Union to help stabilize the military situation in the European cockpit during the Cold War. There were conventional arms limitations, there were observation of maneuvers, there were hotlines, there were verification by each side of what the other side was doing. There were efforts as well to solve the political problems that could give rise to conflict both in Iraq and in the region, and those need to be part of the framework for the negotiations.
That seems like a very sort of exhaustive and sort of comprehensive list.
It's only the beginning.
Only the beginning. I mean, it
seems that.
I think precisely because it's so exhaustive and so complicated, perhaps that's just me, but I've become almost pessimistic about the chances of a solution of to success. I'm wondering, you're, I think, a much more distinguished observer of these things than I, and I'm wondering, in your expert opinion, do you see a chance of what you just outlined happening?
I think it's a very hard slog, but I don't see a better solution yet at hand, and I don't see us winning through the use of military force, even coupled with what we haven't been able to manage, a very, very effective system of assisting in reconstruction and indeed stabilization inside Iraq on the civil side. Much as I would like to see that, it doesn't work that way. And if you go back and look at these kinds of conflicts in the past, sooner or later, one way or another, there is a political workout.
Are there any examples from the past that we might be able to draw on? In your article, you mentioned sort of UN successes in El Salvador and East Timor. Are those analogous?
No, those are very
yeah.
small. A little larger would be Cambodia. Mm-hmm. We've not dealt with anything quite so large. Congo, which was dealt with and became a mess, is not, in my view, necessarily a good answer on this one. And to say that there have been no failures is ludicrous. We should say this is a tough, hard, long shot. But it is not something, in my view, that we should have ignored for 5 years, and it's not something I think we can continue to ignore.
Maybe in our remaining moments we can move on a bit, and I could pick your brains about a few other issues. I read this week that Russia, the Russian Duma, was on the brink of recognizing Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Transnistria, sort of in response to the Western American-led recognition of Kosovo sovereignty. I'm wondering, is this, do you think, the full extent of Russia's reaction to the recognition of Kosovo by the U.S. and other Western states?
I don't really know, and normally a recognition by legislative bodies in international law has no weight. It would have to be the Russian executive that would have to take those steps. I think they know and understand the dangers, if I could put it this way, of vociferousness, as the Brits used to describe it, and that within their own structure they have had a serious problem for a long time, that Chechnya is the outward and most singular and toughest manifestation of that. But I can recall that when I went to Russia first in 1993 as ambassador, there were very serious Russians at high levels very, very much concerned about two potential pieces of breakup. One would be the Far East breaking up. The other was the Muslim oblasts and krais of Russia, who might seek to take it on their own to break up Russia at a time when it was weak, and as a time when you know that Russia itself had been through the breakup of the Soviet Union, and many Russians wondered whether they were kind of on a merry-go-round that wouldn't stop and it would continue to throw off pieces. But that didn't happen. The Russians were very concerned about it. I think that breakup and civil war are the two worst calamities that can assail a modern nation with a strong history and a deep past and a common language. And the Russians themselves have at one time or another seen these things, been through them, and are deeply concerned about them, and will take very serious steps to avoid them. So the notion that, to put this way, kind of to tweak the tale of the West over Kosovo This would be establishing a precedent that I would think the Russians would want to think many times before putting into effect.
It seems you're thinking a few steps down the road farther than I've actually heard any other folks.
Well, yeah. I mean, Dumas aren't known for thinking down the road. So.
Fair enough.
They're known for emotional reactions.
I guess then, sir, if the recognition of these three breakaway regions doesn't happen by the Russian executive, then it seems to me that the other shoe hasn't yet to drop on Russia's reaction to Kosovo's independence.
I think that we might expect a range of activities, but Russia is relatively remote. They have solidified their position with the Serbs. The current Serbian leadership has gone. President Tadic has to bring about a new government. That will be something that will preoccupy everybody in the region for some time. In the meantime, I think that it has gone as well as one could have expected, and that the Russians are clearly not seeing this as a casus belli. Some of this is, of course, generated because in the current very parlous stage of Russian relations with the U.S. and also with the West, something that I think needs serious attention on both sides, the ability to take the kind of actions we've just discussed is not a seriously a limiting factor as I think logic and good sense would require it to be.
We're just about out of time. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for chatting and joining us. And appreciate your time, and hope we can speak again soon.
Thanks, Mark, and delighted to do it.
All right, thanks so much.
Bye. Right.